These pictures of the Minneapolis truck driver's strike, typical of disorders flaring up in various cities, show a spirit of lawlessness which has no place in America. 5,000 are in the milling mob, trying to prevent trucks from delivering needed food to the city. A strong guard of police and distribution of nightsticks to citizen deputies fails to check the crowd, which closes in an ugly mood. Outnumbering the police 10-1, they attack in gangs. The actual beginning of hand-to-hand fighting, in which one deputy was beaten to death and scores were injured.
The episode's begun.
Anders Lee here.
I'm Andy.
What is this, Twitch? You guys do?
Yeah, we are on Twitch. Thanks for watching us on Twitch. So let's get started talking about the episode. Some context about why it's good to talk about this chapter in U.S. labor history today. Because, of course, 1934 marks a high point in the class struggle. Sort of the normal periodization is you get this these waves of class struggle between like 1875 and 1893, and then this period of quiescence, and then the return of kind of large-scale industrial strikes and unionism with the IWW and a surge in the AFL in the 1910s, and then a period of quiescence in the 20s. And then with the Depression, you get this large-scale return of unionism that surpassed anything before. And 1934 is not the high watermark of it, but it's the high point of militancy that the U.S. had not seen since the labor insurrections of the late 19th century, and a prelude to a really massive strike wave, the first of two in 1936 and 7, leading to the creation of the CIO and industrial unionism. So it's an interesting thing to talk about some of the moments that led to that transition out of quiescence and into a militant labor movement. And then also, why didn't that militancy remain? Why did we get the CIO from this militancy, but the CIO did not become a revolutionary anti-capitalist organization or something? And looking at Minneapolis is a really good way to talk about that. It's a good way to think about what labor might look like in the coming years now that we're getting rid of the NLRA and a lot of the New Deal bureaucracy, and we're going back to a time when labor is going to be largely, you know, the state is going to cease to be this mediator between labor and capital the way it was before, and what kind of militancy not only might be called for in the moment, but what can actually lead to workers' power. And 1934 is such a good example because Minneapolis, and you'll get into this in the context that we'll talk about next, but Minneapolis was a very anti-union place. It did not have strong union, considered an open shop town. And then, you know, in the videos that we're playing here, you see some of the labor insurrections of 1934, including in Minneapolis. How did that happen so quickly? And so that's what we're going to try to answer today.
Yeah, so Minnesota in the early 20th century, dominated by the Republican Party. After the Civil War, the Democrats were essentially a non-factor in Minnesota politics. There'd been 2,000 or so, if my memory is correct, Minnesotans killed in the Civil War, and Democrats were seen as the party of the Confederacy, and so very hard for them to get elected in the North, and that definitely included Minnesota. And in the early 1910s, you know, there's some talk of, you know, there's a lot of sort of clandestine illegal labor organizing happening throughout the country. And you have the Socialist Party, which does elect a mayor of Minneapolis in 1916. He refuses to sign a bill banning the IWW. So that's something. And then he quickly is not elected again. Because mostly because of World War One, he's German. I was going to say red baited, but he's already red, so he's kraut baited. They're like, you want the Germans to win, and so there's in the Dakotas, mostly North Dakota. There's this thing called the Nonpartisan League, which is using the mostly the Republican ballot line to elect populist candidates who are doing things like getting a state-run grain elevator, which was a big deal at the time, as well as a state bank, which persists to this day. A lot of people from the Nonpartisan League had their eyes kind of set on Minnesota, and they moved their HQ to St. Paul, which I just want to say for the record, I this is my hometown. My family still lives there in St. Paul and is a bit more of a union town than Minneapolis around this time. You know, the unions have been crushed, and St. Paul, there's a bit more of a labor peace. And that's kind of, I think, a thematic difference between the two twin cities is St. Paul, things are more subtle, more laid back, more chill. And Minneapolis just has, it does have more going on. There's just, and you know, things are more out in the open and exciting and flashy. And so, the capitalist class was more brazen there. Whereas in St. Paul, they kind of, you know, were eager to get along. But in 1918, there's the foundation of the founding of the Farmer Labor Party, which is a third party. You can tell in the name, it's an attempt to fuse the urban workers' movement with farmers who were often very, you know, quite radical at that point in time. And they are quickly become kind of the main competition with the Republicans. Minnesota is a very Republican state at this point and very isolationist. And so especially after World War One, you have this like brief pop of nationalist fervor and then a lot of skepticism throughout the country of like, what the fuck did we just do? What did we have these men go and die for? There's congressional commissions investigating it, and the FLP, Farmer Labor Party, is founded kind of to oppose World War One, so they have a lot of credibility throughout the 20s, but they don't really, you know, they run a lot of people, they got some local electeds, but they're not able to win statewide until 1930, when you have this guy, Floyd Olson, who comes along, and he's a lawyer, was originally from North Minneapolis and grew up actually speaking Yiddish because North Minneapolis was a heavily Jewish community at that time. And he was a Hennepin County district attorney and had actually defended some workers who were put on trial for bombing somebody's house who was a anti-union figure of some kind. So Floyd Olson gets elected in 1930. And the Democrats, again, non-entity, they're very conservative too. He's now the governor and is a very pragmatic figure. That's an important thing to remember about Floyd Olson. He was a good communicator, eloquent speaker.
Yeah, he looks pragmatic. He's got that old timey microphone.
Yeah.
It's good for communication.
Right. That was, you know, he was young and fresh and exciting, and he used the radio to communicate with the people of Minnesota, and very popular, and this is something I found really interesting in the research I've done about this, is that the Farmer Labor Party is a pretty big tent. It does have radicals joining it.
A big barn.
A big barn, if you will. But there's also a lot of social Democrats, and he is able to kind of, you know, he's more of on the social democratic side of things. But back then, even things like unemployment insurance, that's seen as like a really radical demand. And that's not something we can publicly support, is basically what he thought. And so he got them to kind of take that out of the platform. He got them to take normalizing relations with the Soviet Union out of the platform. And he's really focused on hunger and the bare necessities, poverty, and regulation of big business. And so he's elected in 1930. And there's never as far as I know, there's never really a majority farmer labor seats in the Minnesota legislature. So he's in a way he has to work with the Republicans. Is essentially acts as Johnson Democrat or a New Deal Democrat, which at the time was a fairly new phenomenon. And he does make a deal with Roosevelt in 1932 to endorse him, and the Farmer Labor Party backs Roosevelt. He's governor until he dies in 1936. But before that is the strike we're talking about today, in which he plays a very controversial role. I should mention, too, an interesting thing, sort of setting the political context leading up to this. The Farmer Labor Convention is happening in 34, and he is, again, fairly wishy-washy. He calls himself an opportunist. There was a debate he did with a British Marxist revolutionary where Floyd Olson says, you know, he's accusing me of being an opportunist, and he's damn right. I am an opportunist. I take any opportunity I can to help people's needs. But in 34, at that convention, he gives this groundbreaking speech where he says, I am not a liberal. I am what I want to be. I am a radical. It's not enough to tinker around the edges with capitalism. We need a new system, is what he says in that speech. And he's playing to the radical elements in the Farmer Labor Party, and gets a big applause break. There is some speculation, though, that him saying that is a way to sort of acquiesce those that faction of the party, but also kind of hurt the FLP down ballot. So people will hear that and be like, okay, they're open communists. We do like this guy, but the party as a whole, you know, we don't want him to actually govern with a majority. So he continued to his sort of the very tinkering he decried, he did partake in as governor. Also was swooned with the business class of Minnesota. Got along with everybody, which, you know, isn't always a good thing. Politically, he was pretty consistent in doing things they didn't like, but behind the scenes, they would have drinks and stuff. So, yeah, he is governor during this strike, and we'll get into it in more detail, but he from the outset, he is broadly supportive and gives money to the strike fund.
All right, so I'll get into a little bit of the U.S. labor context now before we get into the strike. Like I said, there was a major period of union activity decline between World War One and the Great Depression. There's a quote from Ziegler's The CIO. Wartime and post-war immigration restriction abruptly curtailed the influx from Europe. Demographic stabilization created an emerging second generation of ethnic workers committed to life in America, increasingly distanced from old world customs and familiar traditions, and expecting the continuation of rising standards of security, prosperity, and mobility, the American dream, entering the middle class. Between 1916 and 22, an average of 9% of American workers were involved in strikes annually, with the great 1919 strike wave involving one-fifth of all workers and work stoppages. After the massive coal and railroad strikes of the summer of 1922, however, industrial America quickly settled into apparent quiescence, as remarkable for its placidity as the earlier period had been for its turbulence. Between 1923 and 1930, the number of strikers engaged in stoppages dropped by over 80%. In 1919, there were 3,600 strikes involving 4 million workers. In 1929, there were 921 involving fewer than 300,000. And throughout the late 1920s, reaching in 1930 an incredible 637 strikes and 183,000 workers, representing a minuscule 8% of labor. So this obviously changes when the Great Depression comes, stock market crashes, people get laid off en masse. Those people who continue to have jobs have their pay slashed and are subject to layoffs and have no security whatsoever. In the 20s, unionism had been sort of replaced by corporate various kinds of like corporate unions or things like unions that the corporations gave, including subsidized housing and medical and that sort of thing. And those were all just cut when the Depression comes. So moving on to Minnesota, we'll talk a little bit about Farrell Dobbs,
who was pretty, you know, it seems like a story of an average worker. He was a truck driver from Nebraska, I think. And he was a coal truck driver, and he took a job in Minneapolis, and he was a conservative guy. He supported Herbert Hoover in 1932. FDR was elected. He wasn't a pro-union. FDR was not the pro-union president, you know, he became or like was made out to be, but he was the candidate of people who were starting to mobilize against the Depression early on, unemployment councils, you know, the bonus army. They sort of pushed Hoover out of power in favor of FDR, who seemed like he might be more progressive, but still people like Dobbs, average workers, did not support him. But once in Minneapolis, Farrell Dobbs became very disillusioned with his work as a coal driver because there were seasonal layoffs that were kind of sort of like what we were talking about with the Alamo strike on our episode last week. They used seasonal layoffs to get rid of troublemakers. And even before the seasonal layoffs, you were always nervous about getting fired. And obviously you were living paycheck to paycheck. He had his wages cut constantly. So he met up with Vincent Ray Dunn, one of three Dunn brothers who were also truck drivers in Minneapolis.
Which, by the way, I looked this up. I thought maybe they would be the Dunn brothers of the coffee shop, which is a chain in the Twin Cities, Dunn Brothers. But
that would be cool.
They're different Dunn brothers who are from the Twin Cities and don't have an E at the end of their name, but I was a little disappointed by that.
And so Dunn was, he was pushing the Teamsters Local 574 to include a larger variety of workers, because the Teamsters under this guy Tobin, who's an Irish immigrant, a business unionist, had wanted to constrain the amount of Teamsters and the shops that they were active in the city, and they were a very corrupt operation, not very interested in workers' power, more interested in just maintaining their own kind of craft protection racket, as was a common union tactic of the time, especially in AFL affiliated unions. They weren't looking to build workers' power, you know, throughout an entire city or entire region or entire industry. And so Dunn was a rank and file worker who was affiliated with a proto-Trotskyist group, the Communist League. I'll get into that a little bit. And he was trying to organize more workers into Local 574 to try to address some of the issues that people like Farrell Dobbs were faced with, these seasonal layoffs and pay cuts and such. Dunn was an important player in this because, as a coal driver, the coal industry and the distribution of coal was obviously very important in Minneapolis, especially during the winter, because, you know, everyone needed coal to heat their homes, let alone the industrial uses of coal. So Dunn had made a concerted effort to include a wide variety of coal workers, including truck drivers, in the union. Once a fair number of workers had been rallied to Local 574, there was attempts to negotiate with the employers in Minneapolis between the Teamsters. The AFL tried to mediate these negotiations to the best of their ability, but Dunn was calling these mass meetings and like riling everyone up, getting people angry, making them want to strike. And eventually they were able to strike in February of 1934. Employers continued to refuse to negotiate. AFL fought against the strike vote, but the strike happens, and the strike opens up with these militant direct action tactics that would become a prelude to what would happen later in the year, including like dumping coal in the street and blocking streets and, you know, doing all the things that Teamsters can do as truck drivers, you know, like be on the move and like shut down an entire city, both by not making the deliveries and just by blocking the streets itself, making it hard to bring in scabs, that sort of thing. So the AFL quickly brokers a settlement from the strike. At a meeting, Dunn speaks out against the settlement, but the majority of workers agree to the settlement, believing that the AFL still had their best interest in heart. But Dobbs was deeply inspired by Dunn's militancy and his willingness to take on both the employers and the AFL bureaucracy. This is a quote from his book, Revolutionary Teamster. "One night after a meeting, I went into a beer joint across from the Union Hall and saw Miles Dunn." This is one of the Dunn brothers. There's three Dunn brothers and they have different names, so it gets a little confusing. "He sees Miles Dunn standing at the bar. I took a place next to him, and after engaging in a little small talk, I came right to the point. Are you a communist? I asked. What the hell is it to you? He shot back. I heard that you are, I told him. If it's so, I guess that's what I want to be. Yeah, an important part of the story is that the Dunn brothers and Farrell Dobbs and a few of the other Teamsters were openly communists. And they weren't just any communist, but they were members of the International Left Opposition. This was before the Fourth International. This was the Trotskyist international movement. Their party was called the Communist League. And I'll read a section of Farrell Dobbs' book describing the Communist League. In 1933, the Communist League made a turn towards building a new revolutionary party. The German Communist Party's failure to oppose Hitler's seizure of power in Germany that year had demonstrated the political bankruptcy of the World Stalinist movement. It was clear that a revolutionary revival of the Third International was no longer possible. This imposed the task of constructing new parties throughout the world and uniting them in a new revolutionary international. By that time, the Communist League branch in Minneapolis had grown to about 40 members and close sympathizers. Among them were comrades with long and varied experiences in the trade union and radical movements. With these forces, the branch was in fairly good shape to turn towards mass work as the keystone to building the new party. Objective conditions were becoming more and more favorable for the perspective as the mass radicalization of the day intensified under the pressure of economic depression. The time was ripe, Carl and Ray thought, to speed up the tempo of the Teamster campaign, which they had already been contemplating before they were thrown out of the Communist Party in 1928.
One reason this strike is so interesting is because, you know, one of the common conceptions, fair or unfair, about Trotskyists is that they stand on the sidelines, they don't do anything, they just criticize. And this is an instance where it was Trotskyists leading the way, and they really accomplished something tangible, however fleeting. And the Communist Party really wasn't involved. They were kind of MIA for this.
They were
a couple people, but overall, like,
yeah, they were mostly involved. The Communist Party was strongest during this period in certain immigrant unions and like formations. But yeah, I don't think they were particularly strong in this area because it had this notorious like sort of conservative slant. The Citizens Alliance was very anti-communist. So the Trotskyists kind of had an interesting wedge in this situation. And like he writes, they had been kicked out of the Communist Party in 1928 and started forming their own thing. He continues, workers were radicalizing under the goad of economic depression. To mobilize them for action, it was necessary to start from their existing level of understanding. In the course of the battle, a majority could be convinced of the correctness of the Communist League's trade union policy. They would come to understand that misleadership within the AFL was largely responsible for the fact that not a single strike had been won by the union in the city during the previous decade. To drive the point home, it was imperative to show in the opening clash with the bosses that a strike could be won. The key to all this was the infusion of politically class-conscious leadership into the union through the cadres of the Communist League. Of course, they could not assume immediate leadership of the union. Their role as leaders would have to develop and be certified through the forthcoming struggles against the employers. So this is an important point because they weren't just simply trying to take control of the union or get elected to the city government. They're trying to build a fighting force amongst the working class that was able to show workers, like with this early February 1934 strike, that you could win. And then through winning, people would trust them and they would gain influence that way, but also reshape the way the unions work to be more democratic, to put pressure on the AFL's bureaucratism. And so this transformed the Teamster Union, Local 574 in Minneapolis. It became much more open. It was more citywide, even region-wide. And for the first time, a Teamsters local was able to move towards the industrial form of organization instead of the craft form, taking all workers in a given enterprise into a single union. Oh, and I should say before, when he mentioned Carl, that is Carl Skoglund, not Dunn. This is a Swedish immigrant who was a member of the Communist League. And also important to note that the Ray Dunn had been active in the IWW since the 1910s and had turned to Marxism after that point and become a communist and a Trotskyist. But he had been in this fight for a very long time. And so now we can get into the real action of 1934. In April, Local 574 expanded its organizing efforts to include all trucking industry workers in Minneapolis. In May, the Teamsters vote to strike after employers refuse to recognize the union. May 15th, the strike officially begins. And I'll read now from a really great book about the history of labor insurrections and strikes in the United States, Jeremy Brecker's Strike. And we'll read basically the entire section on Minneapolis because it's very exciting. I should say that a little bit more on the context leading into this was that there had been, basically simultaneous to all this going on, there was a pretty insurrectionary series of strikes and general strikes in San Francisco through the ILA of Harry Bridges, which was a communist-controlled union, although Harry Bridges kind of like pushed it a lot farther than the Communist Party might have liked very quickly, and became like a really, you know, he became like a major inspirational leading figure in the labor movement. And then in April, there was the Autolite plant strike in Toledo, Ohio, and this was on the, under the direction of A.J. Mustey and the American Workers Party. So those two separate kind of like militant factions of Mustey, who is, would become something like a Trotskyist or like a social democrat, and Harry Bridges, who was a communist. And now they would be joined in Minneapolis by this Trotskyist-led labor insurrection. And I'll read from Jeremy Brecker's Strike now. Early in 1934, Teamsters who worked in Minneapolis coal yards struck, caught the employers by surprise, and closed down 65 of the town's 67 coal yards. The employers capitulated in 3 days and granted recognition for Teamsters Local 574. The local held a catch-all charter, making it virtually industrial in character, and truck drivers and helpers in all trades began pouring in. Unofficial leadership in the unions was given to the Dunn brothers and Carl Skoglund, who were American followers of Leon Trotsky. When the truckers refused to sign any agreement with the union, the Teamsters voted at a mass meeting May 12th to strike. Most businesses were hit by the strike. General and department stores, groceries, bakeries, cleaners and laundries, meat and provision houses. All building materials, all wholesale houses, all factories, gas and oil companies, stations and attendants, breweries, truck transfer and warehouses, all common carriers. As the sheriff later put it, they had the town tied up tight. Not a truck could move in Minneapolis.
That's the crazy thing to me. It's like every single factory in Minneapolis was stopped.
No, that's the importance of trucking. The key tactic of the strike was the Flying Squadron, a system of mobile pickets operating out of strike headquarters. An old garage rented for the strike. There were never less than 500 strikers at the headquarters day or night. In the dispatcher's room, four telephones took in messages from picket captains throughout the city with instructions to call every 10 minutes. The dispatcher sent cars from the garage wherever they were needed. A motorcycle squad cruised the city reporting trouble. The strikers listened to police radio instructions on a special shortwave radio and conducted phone calls in code when their phones were tapped. Pickets guarded 50 roads into the city, turning back non-union trucks. A crew of 120 prepared food day and night. At the peak of the strike, 10,000 people ate at the headquarters. A hospital was established with two doctors and three nurses in constant attendance, and a machine shop with 15 auto mechanics kept the 100 trucks and cars of the Flying Squadron in repair. Guards policed the headquarters, and watchmen with Tommy guns stood guard on the roof. Constant PA announcements and night mass meetings attended by thousands of strikers and supporters kept strikers in touch. A rank-and-file committee of 100 truck drivers formed the official strike authority. Support for the strike among other Minneapolis workers was passionate. 35,000 building trade workers walked out in sympathy, as did all taxi drivers in the city. The Farm Holiday Association, a militant farmers organization, made substantial contributions in food, and other unions contributed to the strike fund. Hundreds of other non-Teamster workers showed up at striking headquarters daily, saying, "Use us. This is our strike." And a lot of those workers were unemployed, like people waiting for work, and they joined in, which was a tremendous blow to the employers because that's the reserve army of labor. The city polarized as the business forces, too, began to organize. Leading them was the Citizens Alliance, one of the most powerful employers associations in the country, with its own core of undercover informers. It was dedicated to keeping unionism out of Minneapolis, and for a generation, it had been almost completely successful. Business leaders developed their own strike headquarters with a barracks, hospital, and commissary. As the conflict deepened, they called for a mass movement of citizens to break the strike and began organizing a citizens' army, many of whose members were deputized as special police. with an unusual clarity, two organized social classes stood face to face, poised for battle. The battle was seriously joined on Monday, May 21st. A group of men and women pickets had been severely beaten when they were sent into a police trap by a stool pigeon who had infiltrated the strike headquarters. As the Citizens Army began to occupy the market and move trucks, the strikers hit with military precision. And this is a quote from one of the strike leaders. I think it's Farrell Dobbs, so I'm not sure. The special deputies, Citizens Army, were gradually pushed by our pickets to one side and isolated by the cops. Oh, also the Citizens Army, at least at first, dressed up in like very nice clothes because they wanted to look respectable. And they just like found themselves. When that was accomplished, the signal was given and the 600 men poured out of the Central Labor Union headquarters. They marched in military formation, four abreast, each with their clubs, to the market. They kept on coming. When the socialites, the Alfred Lindleys and the rest, who had expected a little picnic with a mad rabble, saw the bunch, they began to get some idea what the score was. Then we called on the pickets from strike headquarters, who marched into the center of the market and circled the police. The police were put right in the center with no way out. At intervals, we made sallies on them to separate a few. This kept up for a few hours, till finally they drew their guns. We had anticipated this would happen, and that then pickets would be unable to fight them. You can't lick a gun with a club. The correlation of forces becomes a little unbalanced. So we picked out a striker, a big man and utterly fearless, and sent him in a truck with 25 pickets. He was instructed to drive right into the formation of cops and stop for nothing. We knew he'd do it. Down the street he came like a bat of hell with his horn honking and into the market arena. The cops held up their hands to stop him, but he kept on. They gave way and he was in the middle of them. The pickets jumped out on the cops. We figured out by intermixing with the cops and hand-to-hand fighting, they would not use their guns because they would have to shoot cops as well as strikers. Cops don't like to do that.
That's, yeah, one of the interesting takeaways from this. They're willing to fight the cops hand-to-hand, go fisticuffs with cops, but there's a strategic reason behind it, because then they can't just mow down the crowd. If cops
maybe don't. Today they'd be, they had more trigger discipline then, at least. Casualties for the day included for the strikers a broken collarbone, cut open skull of a picket who swung on a cop and hit a striker by mistake, and a couple of broken ribs. On the other side, roughly 30 cops were taken to the hospital.
Damn.
The Monday battle was not decisive, however, and the reserves on both sides mobilized in the market again the next day. An extra 500 special police were sworn in. According to Charles R. Walker's study, nearly every worker who could afford to be away from his job that day, and some who couldn't, planned to be on hand in the market. 20 to 30,000 people showed up. No battle was planned. The melee began when a merchant started to move crates of tomatoes, and a picket threw them through his store window. The pickets, armed with lead pipes and clubs, fought viciously with the police, driving them out of the market within an hour, then continuing to battle them all over the city. By nightfall, there were no police to be seen in Minneapolis. Strikers were directing downtown traffic. This was the famous Battle of Deputies Run. A settlement of sorts was patched together by the governor and federal mediators, leaving the real issues unsettled, and events moved towards a second strike. The chief of police requested a virtual doubling of his budget to add 400 men to the force, to maintain a training school, and to buy machine guns, rifles, bayonets, steel helmets, riot clubs, and motorcycles.
So they give them time to reload.
Not only that, but it just seems like the police had not expected to ever need this much equipment, because things had been so quiet. The employers sponsored an enormous press and radio campaign against the union, stressing an attack by the head of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, calling the leadership communistic. The workers laid in food for a 40-day siege. And so, yeah, this campaign by the Citizens Alliance to say, like, look, this is run by communists.
Yeah,
we're not kidding. Like, these guys are actually, like, into this Trotsky guy who was, you know, a known quantity in the U.S. at the time, as we discussed on our last And.
But he's still alive at this point, and he's met with at least one of the leaders of this strike, like, and people who were there had gotten orders from Trotsky for various things. I don't think he was, you know, coordinating everything. It is funny how even the IBT leadership was like, we don't support these guys, and the business class is pointing to that, but it's still wasn't enough to the public seemed to be relatively supportive at this point.
Yeah, and the idea of the Szilas calling them communists didn't work because at this point the workers knew the Dunn brothers and Skoglund and Farrell Dobbin. Okay, well, those guys are cool. So actually, if they're communists, whatever.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a communist too. And this is something I noticed, you know, in a smaller scale, but in the Amazon organizing in Staten Island. The Communist Party was involved in that too. The anti-union people at Amazon, the either hired or like people who were opposed to the union from within the rank and file, pointed out that, you know, there's communist elements here, and the unionization still went through because people knew the communists and liked them.
Yeah.
So good way to show that these radical ideas aren't just some weird idea that you have to read a book to understand, but like actually these are your coworkers and their tactics can help you get what you want.
Yep.
On July 5th, the largest mass meeting in the history of Minneapolis preceded by a march of farmer and labor groups with two airplanes flying overhead, mobilized support for the Teamsters and displayed the forces that would support them in the event of another showdown. When the Teamsters struck again on July 16th, they reestablished in still more perfected form the strike organization, published a hugely popular strike daily paper, a circulation that went from nothing to 10,000 in 2 days. That's Trotskyist magic right there. And kept farmer support by allowing all members of the farmers' organizations to drive their trucks into town and establish their own market. The first few days of the strike were peaceful. Then the police tried to break it in terror. On July 20th, a truck accompanied by 50 police armed with shotguns started moving in the market. A second truck with 10 pickets arrived and cut across the convoy's path. The police opened fire, and within 10 minutes, 67 persons, including 13 bystanders, were wounded, two fatally. This is a quote from the Citizens Alliance leaders. Nobody likes to see the bloodshed, but I tell you, after the police had used their guns on July 20th, we felt that the strike was breaking. There are very few men who will stand up in a strike when there is a question that they will get killed. That night, an enormous protest meeting ended in a march on City Hall to lynch the mayor and the police chief. The march was headed off by National Guard troops. This together with a huge mass funeral for one of the killed pickets attended by an estimated 50 to 100,000 revealed that whatever its intentions, the massacre had strengthened rather than undermined the workers' determination and solidarity. In this situation, farmer labor governor Floyd B. Olson, who had personally contributed $500 to the strike fund and declared, "I am not a liberal, I am a radical," declared martial law. The governor's official policy was that neither pickets nor trucks, except those delivering food, would operate. But by the second day of martial law, military authorities announced that more than half the trucks in Hennepin County were operating. Faced with the imminent breaking of the strike, the workers decided at a mass meeting attended by 25,000 to resume picketing in defiance of the governor and the National Guard. The governor replied by surrounding the strike headquarters at 4 a.m. August 1st, occupying it, arresting most of the top strike leaders, and instructing the rank and file to elect new leaders. Charles Walker wrote, "The strike's conduct had been such that 1,000 lesser leaders had come out of the ranks and the pickets themselves. By this time, had learned that their own jobs..." Oh, so the picketers now knew how to do the work themselves. So they didn't need the leaders anymore. The arrest of the leaders, instead of beheading the movement, infused it, at least temporarily, with demoniac fury. As one worker said, "We established curb headquarters all over the city. We had 20 of them. In the face of the situation, the governor was forced to back down. He released the captured leaders, turned back the strike headquarters, and raided the Citizens Alliance to save face with his labor constituents. The strike continued, and with the city reeling after a month of conflict, the employer succumbed to the enormous pressures for a settlement and capitulated. The strike supporters celebrated with a 12-hour binge."
Damn. They drank for 12 hours?
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Something we should mention, too, there's a women's auxiliary, which I think that came up, but that was really instrumental in this strike. A lot of wives of workers and just women in Minneapolis were assisting with various things, making food, but doing other things. And they also had a hospital in the strike HQ. Yeah, they had a hospital, which could care for people who were wounded in the violent pickets.
All right. So the workers won. the local 574 gained official recognition from the IBT, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, in October. And from 1935 to 1941, Minneapolis becomes a completely unionized trucking town, with Teamsters using their control of transportation to help organize other industries. The Communist League earned a strong position in Local 574 and grew to over 100 members. Seems kind of small. It went from 40 to 100. But they had cadres and Teamster locals within Minneapolis and various unions through the Central Labor Council. And through organizing the first area-wide contract for any union outside of rail, the Trotskyists established locals of their party wherever there were Teamster locals, from South Dakota to Iowa to Colorado. In December of 1934, the Communist League merged with A.J. Mustey's American Worker Party, who had led a similarly militant strike in Toledo, and that led to the creation of the UAW, the United Auto Workers. And so those parties merged and created the Workers' Party of the United States, which quickly dissolved into the Socialist Party of America 2 years later. And then eventually, with the declaration of the Fourth International, became the Socialist Workers' Party, which still sadly exists today.
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting, the Olson's actions here, there's to this day a big disagreement between Trotskyists and farmer labor rights, who now is the Farmer Labor Party was fused with the Democratic Party in Minnesota. Now it's the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And what they say is that he played this masterfully, and by going after the strike leaders first, then he was able to go after the Citizens Alliance and broker this great agreement that certified the union, made it like an official union with recognition for the bosses. But then the Trotskyists would say he sold them out. He raided Strike HQ, and that is not something a pro-labor official should do. And by, making this an official thing, you kind of neutered it in a way. And that, but it wasn't just Olson, it was also the leadership of that strike, and they kind of took a more official route in general within the Teamsters, and they tried to appeal to labor bosses in other cities and get some changes made and get more recognition for locals like theirs. But they didn't keep that same energy going that was in the really a miraculous strike, that they didn't try to form similar formations throughout the country and have strikes that were done in that similar of a way. And that maybe, if it weren't for Olson making this so, official and cut and dry, then this could have persisted. It could have kept going. And who knows what could have happened? The city of Minneapolis could have been taken over, and Trotskyist revolution would have spread throughout the United States. It's hard to say what the counterfactual would be.
Well, here's a quote from Ziegler in his book about the CIO, about as momentous as 1934 was, especially with these three strikes in San Francisco, Toledo, and Minneapolis, it was still relatively small. Like, you had seen a mass influx into the AFL over the previous 2 years, and then this very insurrectionary year in American labor. But it still didn't approach the kind of 1/5 of workers going on strike that you saw in the 1919. Ziegler writes, veteran laborites and close observers of industrial relations were more skeptical about the revolutionary situation in 1934. True, strike levels rose dramatically, but even in 1934, the vast majority of workers were never on strike and lost time to work. Stoppages amounted to less than 0.2% of all work time. Union membership was up, but even in 1935, it represented less than 10% of the non-agricultural labor force. Social scientists produced seemingly contradictory evidence about the state of mind of the American worker. Many appeared to blame themselves for joblessness and economic failure. At the same time, however, workers seemed determined to find ways to recapture the relative prosperity and promised security of the 1920s, and polling and interview data also revealed high levels of political and social protest. And part of the way the kind of insurrectionary moment of 1935-34 was reined in was that the Teamsters went to war with Local 574. They had to bring them in, but they constantly fought to undermine them. I think at one point they set up like a separate local of Teamsters, and eventually they were able to crush the Trotskyist-controlled Local 574 in 1941 with the Smith Act sedition trials, where 13 Socialist Worker Party members, the leaders of the strike in Minneapolis, were tried and convicted for violation of the Smith Act. And the Communist Party and the AFL both had a role in putting them in prison. And a big part of that was very similar to World War One. The United States was on the verge of war, and the Trotskyists at that point, or leading up to that point, were against, tended to be against entering the war.
World War II.
Yeah. And sadly, on the verge of those sedition trials, one of the Dunn brothers killed himself. Skoglund was blacklisted from the Teamster Union by Tobin. And basically, I think the Teamsters just took back control over the union in 1941 as part of this general effort to make sure there weren't more strikes leading up to the war effort.
Yeah.
There was also, of course, sectarian and legal battles within Local 574 and the broader workers' movement in Minneapolis. The Trotskyist Dunn Vincent was the subject of many heated attacks by his brother Bill, who went on to edit the rival Communist Party newspaper. So basically, the leaders of the strike were sort of wiped from memory. Years later, Jimmy Hoffa, who came to lead the Teamsters after... There was, I forgot what year it happened, the late 40s, I think. Tobin's authority was challenged within the union, and Hoffa came to his defense and became the new Teamster leader out of that. And, you know, what do we know about Hoffa? He's mafia connected. He's deeply corrupt. This was just following the tradition of the Teamsters under Tobin. This was the condition that the Dunn brothers were fighting against in Minneapolis and had to overcome. But nonetheless, Jimmy Hoffa acknowledged the importance of especially Farrell Dobbs in the effort. He said, "I wouldn't agree with Farrell Dobbs' political philosophy or economic ideology, but that man had a vision that was enormously beneficial to the labor movement. Beyond any doubt, he was the master architect of the Teamsters' over-the-road operation." So Hoffa appreciated the tactics, the strong-arm tactics, but was not too interested in challenging capitalism itself. And another interesting fact that I learned about how this memory was kind of wiped away is the Aquatennial. Do you know about this? It's a Minneapolis weekend holiday to celebrate the water of Minnesota. Are you familiar with this?
I don't. I've heard the term just floating out in the ether, but I don't think I ever really learned what that meant.
So it's if you're ever there on July 23rd to 26th, you can celebrate the Aquatennial.
Okay.
And that date was chosen because that was the date of the memorial picnic to the killed workers and had been celebrated every year since. And they created this Aquatennial to as kind of like an alternate holiday so people would forget about that.
Huh. Yeah. I mean, it has really been rubbed out of history in Minnesota and the consciousness. I mean, it's both Twin Cities are union towns, but this is not something you learn about in school. Definitely not. I mean, this does seem like it informs a lot of the current Trotskyist skepticism of unions,
yeah,
and organized labor, because they got burned so bad. So now they're not fans of reform movements like the Teamsters for a Democratic Union. For instance, I think it's, you know, all kind of,
well, I think there's Trotskyists who were involved in that, or like maybe it was like a Trotskyist.
Or sorry, Jack, I'm painting with a bit of a broad brush, right. But if you look on like World Socialist website,
yeah, they're very against the union. They want to destroy the unions.
Yeah.
But I would say the more typical Trotskyist position is kind of in between those two.
Yeah.
They understand the need to create powerful rank and file shop committees that can push the union towards a combative stance with the employers and then, you know, fight the union bureaucracy if they need to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the strike shows the absolute necessity to do that, because if the AFL had their way, there would not have been the February strike. The conciliation of the February strike would have served future conciliations, and there would not have been this massive surge of Teamster, truck driver, industry-wide organizing in Minneapolis. And 2 years later, in 1936, there's the beginning of the sit-down strike movement in Akron and in Detroit as well, where workers who are at this point totally fed up with the AFL, you know, millions of workers joined the AFL in the previous years, but by 1936, they're totally fed up with it. They're fed up with the Roosevelt administration and the NRA. They start essentially occupying their factories, both against the wishes of the employers, obviously, but also the union bureaucracies. And in these sit-down strikes, they start talking to each other, and they form the basic structure of a kind of rank-and-file democracy in these factories. And this tactic spreads massively all throughout the country, and you finally start to see the kind of industry-wide strike waves that have been absent in the United States for decades. And this leads to the creation of the CIO, which was the victory of industrial unionism as opposed to craft unionism. Of course, the CIO sort of follows a similar trajectory, you know, capitulating during wartime, committing themselves to anti-strike pledges. When the war ends, there's another massive industry-wide strike wave that's very successful.
Right.
But the anti-radicalism of the CIO, including its Communist Party elements, only capitulates further at the end of the decade when a new Red Scare rears its face. And that leads to the total radical neutering of the AFL and CIO. So, yeah, I guess to maybe draw some conclusions from this, when these strikes happen, we can't expect the union leadership to actually push us towards a strike. There's talk that, you know, the UAW is talking about this nationwide general strike or a national strike on May Day 2028. And so I think a lot of people are like orienting towards that. But their interest is not a confrontation with capitalism. It's it's a apocal moment to like expand union power and put the labor movement as it exists on a better foot in 2028. So if it's going to go beyond that, and if it's going to succeed even in its own goals, there has to be something like a rank and file movement pushing this kind of militancy forward. And so Minneapolis, I think, provides a lot of lessons both in how that forms and how it can push farther, and also how quickly things can change, you know? Like we talked at the beginning of this episode about how everything was very quiet. You know, Minneapolis was quiet, anti-union place run by largely by the Citizens Alliance and by like a handful of progressives. But none of them really wanted to see this major union upsurge that had to be done by the workers themselves. And once workers saw it was something that they could join in and win and started fighting for their lives, essentially, amazing things could happen. Yeah, that was how 1934 served as this like incredibly insurrectionary year in the United States that really hadn't seen anything like that since the 20th century.
Yeah, you need the Trotskyists there in this case too, because both the union and the communist movement are both being a little sheepish about taking the fight to the streets and to the bosses. A coda to the Floyd Olson thing. While this is happening, one of his sort of loyal lieutenants in the Farmer Labor Party and movement is this guy, Elmer Benson, who ends up being his successor. 1936, Floyd Olson dies of stomach cancer, and Elmer Benson is elected in a landslide because people are so upset that Olson died. And he is, I would contend, the most radical person to govern an American state. I'm going to do a un-Minnesotan thing and toot my own horn for a second. And I have an article, I think, as far as I know, the only article written about him in the 21st century. I dug into his biography. And he watched that strike very closely in 1934. And he said, well, if I'm ever governor, I'm not going to do this. And he gave a speech saying, I will not use the authority of the executive to crush unions or strikes or impede strikes in any circumstance. I'll only use them to promote that strike and aid that strike. And he used the Minnesota National Guard to aid strikes. There were scab trucks in some cases that he would use the National Guard to stop and keep these strikes going. And he, would negotiate, and then Olson would do this as well, be the negotiator, the arbiter as governor, and threaten to use, National Guardsmen to, if there was a capital strike, to fill in where needed. So, that is, an overlooked, part of this too. I will say though, he was only governor for 2 years. He was defeated in a landslide, another landslide in 1938, which is like a Republican, wave year. So, there's challenges, in every direction with this.
How do we go from the Farmers Labor Party of that era to Tim Walz?
Well, in 1944, there's the merger. Republicans have been winning in Minnesota, and Roosevelt says, you guys got to figure something out because you have two sort of left of center parties, and he wants to win Minnesota, even though he's going to win big that year. And so they fuse. And at first, the farmer labor wing is dominant. And then, thanks to an upstart guy by the name of Hubert Humphrey, the socialists are purged. There's the farmer labor wing, and then there's the socialist wing of the farmer labor wing. They were purged, and a lot of the more progressive elements were purged. But the DFL was still a fairly progressive Democratic Party for much of the 21st or 20th century. And then today, the reason Tim Walz, I think, has done so many progressive things is because of that kind of history. And to this day, I would say the Minnesota DFL is a few notches to the left of the average state Democratic Party. So Walz is a moderate in Minnesota, which puts him to the left of most Democrats, for better or worse.
But do you think he stands Farrell Dobbs?
I don't know if he knows too much about him. I mean, I'm sure he was present at there was like a statue for Nellie Stone Johnston, who was a farmer labor activist, a black woman, very significant historical figure on the left in Minnesota. But I don't think he would probably
more into Deng Xiaoping thought.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he's standing Farrell Dobbs. I don't think he's standing James Cannon or any Trotskyists. I think we can say that.
Oh, and speaking of James Cannon, it's important to note that, Cannon was the Communist League secretary in New York, and he had written a lot. He had, ghostwritten a lot of the texts that were coming out in Minneapolis during the strike. I think they visited at some point, but yeah, there was a nationwide Trotskyist coordination for this. Obviously it impressed Trotsky quite a bit. He called the leaders of the strike the natural leaders of Trotskyism in the United States. But sadly, they never really had any victories quite like that in the United States ever again. This is kind of the history of Trotskyism, is like that in some times, in some places, everything kind of like hits right. And they have a massive success and increase their influence to some degree, but then it kind of isn't able to sustain itself. Yeah. All right, maybe we can wrap it up there, or unless there's any questions in the chat, we can call it a night.
I was going to say, too, Max Schachtman was present during...
Oh, Schachtman as well. Yeah, Schachtman and Cannon both came, and they were both ghostwriting some of the Trotskyist literature for the strike.
Yeah, and Schachtman shows up in a cowboy hat and immediately gets arrested because he stands out. And
wow, that's hilarious.
Later, Trotsky says he's kind of a disappointment in this because he wanted him to take a leadership role, and Schachtman was more accustomed and suited to being a journalist and sort of analyzing the situation. If I could just shout out this book, Revolutionary Teamsters, which goes into pretty good detail. It's came out 2013 by the Canadian Trotskyist scholar Brian D. Palmer, who unfortunately does the word labor is spelled with a U throughout the book because he's Canadian.
But we got to get an English translation of that.
Yeah.
I'll also shout out Jeremy Brecker's Strike, a great book that will be in the show notes. And then this article in Cosmonaut, which goes into quite a bit about
the treacherousness of the Teamsters through all this by Edgar Esquivel, who is a lifelong Teamster himself. So that'll all be in the show notes. Everett in the chat asked if we're on YouTube. Pod Damn America is on YouTube, I believe.
Yes.
If you want to. So, yeah, check out Pod Damn America on YouTube. And check out the Antifada and our side project where Andy and Anders talk about whatever we feel like talking about. Thanks for watching and listening, everybody.
All right, it's finished.
Now, back in the year of 33, just my papa, my mama, and me. Papa drove a truck from sun to sun, and mama's work, it was never done. No union. No union. Then this Teamster man showed up one day, told Pop about conditions and better pay. It won't be easy, he told my Pop. When the boss hears about it, he's gonna blow his top. He won't like it. The truckers started to spread the word around. Teamster power was the talk of the town. I heard Papa's words, I remember them well. To organize a union's like walking through hell. But it was worth it. Still no union. Then union busters came and things got rough. Trucker was a man, he had to be tough. Some got hurt, and some of them died. Children were hungry and women cried. Man, do I remember. It took a few years to get it together. Things for us got a whole lot better. Those early truckers had a lot to say about the way we're living today. And you'd better believe it. Teamster power. As I head south on Interstate 5, what would Papa say if he were alive? The temperature in here is 70 degrees. Outside it must be 103. It do make it nice. Would he like my stereo? Country music never ends. How about my old CB talking to his friends? If he heard the songs I like, would he be surprised? Just like him, I dig Bob Wills. Tears would fill his eyes. San Antonio Rose. Country music. Well, I'm about to hang it up. It's pension time for me. But I'll hang around the truck stops to see who I can see. We got it better now, but if it's gonna last, we gotta keep in mind the Teamsters saved our ass.